Good morning, everyone. I want to share with you some words that helped me reflect on our theme this morning. These are from a woman named Jill Suti, and it's called Four Ways Social Support Makes You More Resilient. So, words by Jill Suti. When my mother died, the first thing I did was call my two best friends. Like good friends will, they dropped everything and came to my rescue. Having them there made all the difference in getting through a very difficult period in my life. Researchers have always emphasized this kind of social support. Let me start that sentence again. Researchers haven't always emphasized this kind of social support as a factor in individual resilience. That is, the ability to recover from hardship and move forward in a positive, adaptive way. Instead, they have placed a high premium on studying personal qualities, often relegating social context to a lesser role. For example, studies have found that people who are happier have a stronger purpose in life or higher levels of self-efficacy, the belief that they have control over their situation. Seems to have an easier time recovering after disaster. Some of these personality factors have been shown to be protective, even for those who suffer from economic hardship, and can lead to better health outcomes, a reduced risk of suicide, and a better recovery after the loss of a spouse or a loved one. Still, the research surrounding resiliency is complex and varied. In some cases, resiliency may look a bit different depending on the type of hardship being faced, like the loss of a spouse versus the long-time effects of childhood abuse. Certain protective factors that may help one group of people don't necessarily help another, and some studies show that resiliency is not a stable trait but fluctuates over time, suggesting that it is subject to developmental or environmental changes. Not personal attributes alone. A lost in the mix of resiliency research is the importance of social circumstances. How resilient we are may have as much or more to do with our social milieu of and circle of support, our communities, our institutions, our cultural expectations, as it does with our personal strengths. As resiliency researcher Elliot Friedman says, the availability of social support in all its forms, instrumental support, emotional support, support with how you think about things, they all matter and help us in facing challenge. Though we may think it's easier to change ourselves when it comes to facing adversity, to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps, as they say, research suggests that positive relationships and supportive environments have an important role to play. So I invite you all to think about this for a moment of silence before we start the service sermon.
Reverend Danielle Weber, who goes by the pronouns she, they, is a white queer minister living in the traditional and unceded territory of the Okanagan Siksik people in Kelowna, BC, with her partner Adam and their 95-pound lap dog, Bryn. Danielle is a third-generation UU. They decided to become a minister in 2012, while completing several degrees, including their master's from Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago, Illinois. Reverend Danielle's leadership studies thesis focused on creating relationships between churches and other nonprofit organizations to develop community engagement and leadership development. Throughout their education, Reverend Danielle focused on multi-generational, multicultural faith formation, recognizing that we can create moments of meaning making no matter what we are doing and how we are gathered. Now there's alliteration for you. Essential to Reverend Danielle's work is bringing to light the the expansiveness of Unitarian Universalism. Through leaning into interdependence, recognizing that faith formation can happen everywhere, UUs can become radically inclusive in creating space within our communities for those already here and those joining. Welcome, Danielle. And everyone will have an opportunity to speak and chat, ask questions with her during our community dialogue. Reverend Danielle.
Thank you so much, Brenda. And thank you so much again for the invitation to be with you all this morning. So to pull oneself up by the bootstraps, this is a very common turn of phrase in our world today, often referring to the ideas of succeeding only by one's own efforts or ability, or to recover from a setback without an outside help. It is used to suggest that people who are down and out shouldn't need the support of those around them to cope or survive. For example, people who are poor and the greater population should not have to pay taxes to support them. Or when someone has been successful in their careers and moved to the top of the corporate ladder, they have bootstrapped themselves. It's also a common term for the current gig economy, or the concept that individuals are independent contract online workers due to the fact that one income is not sufficient enough to support themselves. But where did this term come from? And is our understanding of it accurate? Well, as a matter of fact, it's actually a really old turn of phrase, and it's attributed to a set of fictional stories written in 1780, The Surprising Adventures of Baron Munchausen, in which the main character attempts to claim that he pulled himself out of a swamp by grabbing onto his bootstraps and yanking. At the time of the stories, it was presumed that Baron Munchausen was claiming a ludicrous, far-fetched, and even an impossible task. Interestingly enough, this name, Munchausen, is also where the term Munchausen syndrome comes from, or more appropriately named fictitious disorder, in which a patient feigns illness, either due to emotional or mental illness. So how did we get from the idea of pulling oneself up by the bootstraps as a ludicrous idea, and even suggesting the possibility of an individual lying about their situation, to a concept of enterprise, recovery, and individual success? Somewhere along the way, we shifted from a sense of collaboration and connection, evident by the ridiculousness of going it alone, and pulling oneself out of a swamp by bootstraps, to a community of individualism, self-sufficiency, and dare I say, isolation. I was ordained into Unitarian Universalist ministry 2.5 years ago, and it was in Calgary, my home congregation, where the service happened. And at the beginning of the service, we had a land acknowledgement from two of the Indigenous women that I had the opportunity to work with from 2013 to 16. Kate, the elder, offered a welcome to the land where we were. Kate told those gathered in Calgary about the people who lived there before the settlers came, talking about the Piikani, Kayani, Siksika, and Dene peoples. One thing that she said that was really profound for me was this: you need lots and lots of people to help survive in this traditional territory. There's not a lot of wood, and you have to travel far to get our resources. This was something that I knew, and yet it was a new way of knowing for me. A recognition that Indigenous peoples in other territories might live in small family groupings, but in the prairies, large groups of people stayed together to help one another survive. Similar to this idea, I remember a story that my grandfather told me about growing up in southern Manitoba in the 1940s and 50s. He was a farm boy. My great-grandfather farmed grain, and my great-grandmother kept a vegetable garden, or I suppose nowadays, what would be considered a small farm, seeing as how they had enough garden plots to feed their family of 8 kids and 2 parents, all of the vegetables that they could eat throughout the winter. And they also kept some animals, chickens mostly for their eggs, and cows both for milk and meat. My grandpa told me that they belonged to a cattle share with neighboring farms. What this meant was that each month, one of the farms would donate a cow to be killed and butchered so that all 6 of the families would be able to eat meat for 2 months, and then the next family would offer the same. In this way, each family would only have to share one animal, but they would be fed all year round. There was a recognition not only in my grandfather's time and in the time before Europeans made it to Turtle Island, what is now called North America, that supporting one another was the only way we were able to survive, let alone just be resilient. But to actually survive the cruelties of this land and the necessities of being human. Somewhere along the way, we were separated from this idea of communities, offering more substantial support to its members. One of the easiest ways for me to describe my idea of the divine, my idea of the sacred, or even of God, is by talking about an exercise I had to do in seminary. I was taking a class called Unleashing Your Multicultural Ministry, and the first day that we were together, we were asked to help decorate the altar that would be at the front of the room for the rest of our time together. My professor, Re Mark Hicks, who was a religious educator at heart and who loved to incorporate different ways of learning into his curriculum, gave us the task of taking home several pipe cleaners and to create an image that for us would reflect God, spirit of life, the more ultimate reality. Choose whatever name suits you best. Now, I am not a theist. I don't think I have ever been a theist. I grew up a Unitarian in a fellowship church, and I listened to the stories of Jesus and God like it was a fairy tale. For me, stories from the Bible held the same symbolism of love and morals that Winnie the Pooh stories held. And it wasn't until I was a preteen that I actually discovered that Jesus was a man who really existed and really lived through all of those struggles. Before this, he was just a character in my Sunday school classes. However, having spent 3 years in seminary and working through my theological reflections, I was able to claim my own belief in God. Not a Christian sense of God, because I'm still not a theist, but using the word God to mean more than just a deity, to mean more than a proper noun. Now, I know Wikipedia is not considered the most reliable source for information. However, Wikipedia states that the concept of God, as described by theologians, commonly includes the attributes of omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, divine simplicity, and as having an eternal and necessary existence. In that same wiki article, God has also been described as incorporeal, the source of all of our moral obligation, and the greatest conceivable being in existence. And while the Christian God can be described using all of these words, the Christian God is not the only thing that fits this definition. I believe that God is relationships. The being that I recognize as all-knowing, ever-present, and all-powerful. The concept that holds my moral obligations. And the thing that is the greatest conceivable being in existence is our relationships to one another. Whether it's my individual relationship with each of you, or the special relationship that this group of us here on this Zoom room create together, or the relationship that I have with myself or the earth. It doesn't matter. It is the relationship that is important. How we are in that relationship, how we engage the other and how we don't, how we hold the other's emotions and logic, how we choose to change our behavior because of the relationship, or how we choose to ignore the relationship by not changing. This is my God. And though it may not be a personal being, it is divinely simple, and its existence is necessary. It holds our moral obligation, and I believe that it is the greatest conceivable existence. And much like the Christian God, I believe that relationships can be misunderstood, misrepresented, and even abused. So in order to create an image with pipe cleaners for my assignment that year, I created two people holding hands. I wanted to show the space between them, the relationship that I see as God, the connections that hold one another, that knit us together in the fabric of this world. This, for me, is the divine that needs to be witnessed and worshiped. And this idea is expressed and perhaps more wholesomely described by the theologian and philosopher, Dr. Henry Nelson Wyman. In his book, Man's Ultimate Commitment, Henry Nelson Wyman suggests that we have a need to live, a need in our lives to achieve the infinite potentialities presented to us at birth. He stresses the importance of our commitment to a lifelong process that enables us to live our lives to the fullest. In order to obtain the greatest human good, one has to commit to live creative interchange from within. This special human interchange that Wyman coined creative interchange is our ability to learn what others have learned, to appreciate what others have appreciated, to feel what others feel, imagine what others imagine, and to creatively integrate all of this within what we have already acquired and form this way our true individuality. Described a bit differently, creative interchange is experience, the kind of experience that transforms us in ways in which we cannot be transformed by ourselves. As we meet in shared experience, we become more fully human in ways in which we could never have predicted or bring about by striving to do so by ourselves. If we attempt to extrapolate this idea of creative interchange, a practice of becoming more fully human in ways that we could not have done so by ourselves alone, and combined it with the notion of cooperation, collaboration, and connection to the people surrounding us, then it would seem that we need one another more than ever for our resiliency. Our need to rely on one another is not only tied up with our survival on the harsh prairie lands 100 years ago, or before the modern technologies and infrastructure was developed, nor is it tied up in the farming life of the first half of the 20th century. But it is also wrapped up in our spiritual resilience. An integration of our experiences with others is the only way in which we are going to become more fully human. For me, a faith community, a Unitarian Universalist church, encompasses many of the needs for human life. It gives us the space to question, struggle, and perhaps come to an understanding of theological questions, and perhaps we could call those the big questions of life. A faith community should allow us a space to care for and to be cared for, not only in our moments of sorrow, pain, struggle, and strife, but also in the moments of joy and celebration, achievements, and peace. Being part of a community that cares means that you are witnessed as you go through the roller coaster of life. It also means that there is a community of people who can discern about our commitments with. Discovering what ethical, spiritual, financial, and relational commitments are appropriate for us. And we are able to discover what issues in the world are worthy of our energy. Working for justice, perhaps fighting for justice, realizing injustices and learning about each other's opinions of justice is all made easier when a community struggles with the big questions, when they have cared for one another and discovered what their commitments are. When I dream of belonging to a community, this is what I think of. A place where I can seek and share my views, to struggle and discern with what I believe is right, good, wrong, real, necessary, or possible. There are people who will care for me and I for them. We will celebrate one another and offer solace when it is needed. I will look to those in my community to help me discover what to commit to figure out where my resources of energy, time, commitment, finances, and talents should be put. And I will discover who and what I care about in the greater community and in our world. I do not look to be guided through my community life, but I want to be encouraged to ask, ponder, and choose my path. And I would hope that a community, a faith community, would help me be responsible for those decisions. Perhaps we cannot know personal resilience until we belong to a community that helps us find our strengths, determine what our resources are, discover what we believe, and to figure out our path. Maybe it is, as Jill Sudi suggested, that we cannot know personal resilience until we have social support around us, be that our personal relationships that we have with one another, or the social safety nets that support us, like healthcare and parental leave. I think it is foolish to believe that we can get through life all by ourselves. It seems as ridiculous as being pulled about. It seems as ridiculous as being able to pull myself out of a swamp by yanking on my bootstraps. And yet often, when we reach out for those who we are in connection with, we feel a sense of shame and neediness, an internal struggle with our own worthiness. And so here I encourage you to lean into your community, to lean into the power of your community, in order to not have to go it alone and have personal resilience. Thank you. Thank you for listening.